Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast, episode 56. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer, and I'm here with my co-host, Michael Morale. Michael, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Kevin. How about yourself?
Doing really well. Just living the quarantine life here during COVID-19 epidemic, but it's all good. And so today we have another roundtable discussion for all of you, and we have a special guest with us today. Joining us is Ralph Yanez. Ralph is a columnist for one of our sister sites and Muscular Dystrophy News Today. And he is also a disability rights activist. And the reason we're bringing him on today is because in the second half of this episode, we're going to be talking about the new Netflix documentary, Crip Camp, which I'm sure many of you have heard about. I've written about as well. And this is a really powerful documentary about the disability rights movement. And so we really wanted to get Ralph's perspective on this, and I think he has a great perspective to bring to this discussion. So, Ralph, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Kevin, Michael, good to be here. Thank you.
Absolutely. And, Ralph, tell listeners what the name of your column is on MD News Today.
Yes, it's Living, Learning, and Thriving, and I've been doing it just over a year. It's been fabulous, a great experience.
That's great. And, yeah, no, and I think it's great because about a range of subjects from your own personal experiences to, like I said, disability advocacy. So thanks for coming on today. I think this will be a really good discussion. So as I said, that will be the Crip Camp discussion will be the second half of this episode. And in the first half, Michael is going to be breaking down the different SMA treatments we have on the market. Well, both on the market and in development right now and in clinical trials. And there was also some news recently regarding risdiplam. So Michael is going to kind of take the reins on that portion of the episode and break down each of the main treatments for SMA and talk about any news there. So Michael, on that note, why don't we go and get started there? So I'm going to kind of let you take, as I said, the reins on this and break down the different treatments and any news you want to share. So take it away.
Okay, Kevin. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to compare the different treatments that are available to those of us with SMA. And a lot of the information that I'm going to be going over is probably well understood by the majority of us with regards to Biogen's Spinraza and AveXis's Zolgensma. But there are some other treatments that are going to be coming out here in the not so distant future that I think if we compare all of these together, we may be able to see some of the differences that each one of these treatments is going to provide us. Let's first start out with Biogen and their treatment known as Spinraza. Spinraza was approved by the FDA in December 2016 to become the first approved therapy for SMA patients. It was priced at $750,000 for the first four loading doses and then $375,000 every year for the rest of our lives, which basically equates to one injection every 4 months or three injections per year. Spinraza was approved for all types of SMA, types 1, 2, 3, and 4, and for all ages. Spinraza is delivered via an intrathecal or IT injection, otherwise known as a lumbar puncture. Patients receive these injections in their backs, similar to an epidural given to women who are giving birth, or if their backs are not accessible due to their spinal fusions, the injections can be done through their sides or their neck, which is also known as a cervical injection. SMA patients either have a defective SMN1 gene or a missing SMN1 gene, and every SMA patient has a backup copy of the SMN1 gene, and it's called the SMN2 gene. The SMN2 gene produces the same kind of protein as the SMN1 gene does, but at lower levels. And that's the reason why those of us with SMA are weak, is because our bodies are having to rely on that SMN2 gene, which produces the protein, just not at the same level as the SMN1 gene does. Think of SMN2 gene, or think of the SMN2 gene, as a 10-word sentence. If you remove the seventh word in the 10-word sentence, the sentence becomes incomplete. Likewise, if you remove what they call the seventh exon in the DNA structure, the protein becomes incomplete. Spinraza helps to bind that seventh exon back into the DNA structure, thus making it a functional and viable copy. So that's Spinraza, basically in a nutshell. Now, AveXis Pharmaceuticals has a treatment known as Zolgensma, and Zolgensma was approved by the FDA on May 24th, 2019, and it's priced at $2.125 million. Zolgensma became the first gene therapy for patients with SMA, and it became the second FDA-approved treatment or therapy for those of us who have SMA. At the current time, Zolgensma is only available to infants and toddlers up to the age of 2, and it's administered through an IV or intravenous infusion. If Zolgensma was to be given to adults, like you and me, Kevin, via an IV or intravenous infusion, the treatment would not be able to get past what they call the blood-brain barrier, which, if you think about it, is an impermeable barrier that surrounds the spinal cord and the brain. So AveXis is currently working on clinical trials to test the IT or intrathecal delivery system to those of us that are older. And if it's passed by the FDA, Zolgensma will become available to those of us that are older. But these clinical trials are not scheduled to end until, I believe, sometime in 2021, and it may be as late as 2022. Zolgensma works by replacing the SMN1 gene, while Spinraza repairs the SMN2 gene, which is the backup copy of the SMN1 gene. Zolgensma replaces the entire SMN1 gene. Gene therapy has really been around for quite some time, but up until now, if the gene was modified in any way, eventually it would revert back to its old structure. Now Zolgensma is allowing these modifications to become permanent, or at least they have been so far in the clinical trials and in the patient population that are currently taking Zolgensma right now. So that, in a nutshell, is AveXis's Zolgensma. Now I'm going to get into a couple of other therapies that will become available here in hopefully the not-so-distant future. Roche and Genentech currently have their potential treatment, known as risdiplam, under FDA review to become the third approved treatment for those of us with SMA. Unfortunately, at this time, pricing is not yet available, but Roche and Genentech have said that they are going to possibly underprice this treatment to make it available to a wider population. Risdiplam was given priority review status by the FDA and tentatively scheduled to be announced for either approval or denial on May 24th of this year. The Sunfish trial is being tested on infants and children and adults up to the age of 25. Recently, the FDA requested further data from Roche so that they could expand the label to include an older and wider population. This delay had nothing to do with the COVID-19 pandemic. SMA News Today recently interviewed a representative from Roche, and they told SMA News Today that the FDA had requested this additional data back in February, before the COVID-19 pandemic began. Risdiplam will become the first oral treatment for those of us who suffer from SMA. It will work similar to Spinraza, meaning that it will be modifying the SMN2 gene. Many patients were unable to take Spinraza due to either their spinal fusions or other medical conditions, which made it impossible for doctors to inject the Spinraza treatment into the central nervous system. Risdiplam, being an oral treatment, will allow everyone the ability to take this treatment, irregardless if they had had spinal fusion or not. Patients who don't have the ability to swallow will also be allowed to take risdiplam because it can be administered through a G-tube. So, in a sense, that's risdiplam in a nutshell. It should be available, hopefully, by August of this year. Tentatively, they've moved the date from May 24th to August 24th, but hopefully it will be approved before then. But the date that the FDA is giving us is August 24th of this year. Now, the last treatment that I want to go over is one by Scholar Rock. Scholar Rock is a pharmaceutical company, and they're currently conducting clinical trials for their potential treatment known as SRK-015. Unfortunately, the pricing is not available at this time. But Scholar Rock first announced SRK-015 at the 2018 annual Cure SMA conference, which was held in Dallas, Texas. And that was the first time that I actually got to meet Kevin face-to-face because we had worked with each other for a couple of months. So it was nice to meet up with Kevin at that point. But SRK-015 works by reducing the amount of a substance in our body called myostatin. And myostatin is a growth inhibitor for skeletal muscles in all SMA patients. The higher level of myostatin in our bodies reduce our body's ability to allow muscles to grow. And SRK-015 will reduce the level of myostatin, thus allowing our muscles the ability to get stronger. SRK-015 will be the first therapy, if approved by the FDA, to address this particular growth inhibitor, which would do something that the other three approved treatments haven't been able to do, or at least haven't addressed. Unfortunately, we're not able to get too much more information regarding Scholar Rock's potential treatment, because the FDA will not allow them to release further information until they go through the approval process. So basically, that's SMA 101 with regards to the treatments. You know, I've always said that we have a lot to look forward to, and I mean what I say. We really do have a lot to look forward to, because if you think back 5, maybe 6 years ago, we had no treatments at all. So we're definitely seeing a growth with regards to these treatments becoming available. And I think in the coming years, we're going to be astonished with regards to what's available to those of us with SMA. I invite everyone who's listening to this roundtable discussion to please log on to www.smanewstoday.com/forums and create an ID, because we're going to be talking about these treatments. And anytime that we get any late breaking news or any updates regarding these treatments, we're going to make sure that we pass it along to all of you. All right. So that's everything that I had to say. Back to you, Kevin.
Michael, thanks for that summary. That was really informative. And yeah, no, it is. And thank you also for clearing up the news regarding risdiplam's delay. But yeah, so thank you for that. I think that was a great summary. And for our listeners out there, if you have any further questions, you know, listen to it. We go into even more detail on some of the treatments in other episodes of this podcast. There's also daily articles on our main website and posts on our forum. So feel free to reach out to us anytime. But again, Michael, thank you for that summary. That was great. Now we will move to the second part of this episode and talk about Crip Camp. So as I said in the intro, Crip Camp is a new Netflix documentary directed by Jim Lebrecht and Nicole Noonan. I think that's how you say her last name. And it is a documentary about this camp that took called Camp Jened, that took place in the 50s and 60s. I think right outside of Alabama, if I'm not mistaken. And it was a camp designed for teenagers with disabilities. And the reason it was so revolutionary is because for the first time, campers there were made to feel like they were actually humans and they were accepted and they actually got to be who they were. And you'll see that it's a very hippie style camp reflective of Woodstock and the social movement of that time. And what happened is that the community that formed at this camp in the 60s is what led to the early disability rights movement. So it is a fascinating documentary that explores, the first half really explores the camp itself and the experiences that those people had. And the second half of the film, it explores the disability rights revolution. So starting with figures like Judy Heumann and the 504 sit-ins, all of which led to Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. And that eventually led to the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990. So it is a really fascinating film. If for listeners out there, if you have not seen the film yet, I would kind of encourage you to go watch it and then come back and listen to this portion of the episode, because we are going to go into deep spoiler territory and discuss specific scenes in the film. And so please go watch it first. But if you have, we're excited to have you here. So let's start with just our general impressions. Ralph, why don't we start with you? Just talk, I know you and I have both seen it twice, and can you just talk about your initial impressions of the film, any key takeaways you had?
Yes, absolutely, and you're right. I actually started to watch it a third time, so I'll probably get through it a few more times, but for me, there were really two major takeaways. I mean, first, obviously, just the beauty of the camp itself and the uniqueness of what happened there. I mean, to me, it really showed the limitless nature of human potential. You know, my motto in my column is often that all of us really are experts and have become experts at creative living, living creatively. And this camp really had a creativity that I had never seen before. And, you know, the fact that this happened in the 50s and 60s and early 70s is just amazing. You know, I knew a lot of the second piece of what I'm going to talk about in a moment, the advocacy piece, but I didn't realize even that this existed. And it was really just amazing. And what I saw there is individuals thriving like they never had before. And then for me, the second piece is really my bailiwick, where I really focus, and that's that advocacy piece. It's amazing that the camp participants, you know, first they had their lives changed at the camp, but many of them then basically took that experience and went on to change our lives with the work they did. I've done a lot of lobbying at federal and state levels and doing community organizing. And these folks really did it at the greatest levels. There are some amazing scenes where they're blocking streets in big cities and not letting the traffic through, and you know, things that we may have to do again someday as we continue to fight for rights. You know,
absolutely. No, it really. Just the community that evolved there. I think we're going to talk about this more. But also I was totally mistaken there. It was, the camp took place in New York. I don't know why I said Alabama, but my bad there. But yeah, no, Ralph, that's great. And I'm very interested in talking with you about your lobbying experiences, especially as we talk about, the scenes that explore the disability rights movement. So I'm really interested in that. Michael, what were your initial impressions of the film or any key takeaways?
You know, I thought it was a great film, and while I was watching it, it actually made me flash back to when I went to summer camp one time. I was 7 years old. Now, it wasn't this same camp, of course, but it was run through the Lions Club, and it was in the Hill Country in Texas, and so it was out toward the Kerrville, Texas area, and I can almost promise you that the same hippies that were running Camp Jeanette were also running the camp that I went to, because everybody looked exactly like they did in this video. Long hair, you know, bandanas, playing guitars. And this camp was basically set up similar to what Camp Jeanette was. It was for handicapped children, whether it be physical or mental. It was probably more physical handicap than it was anything. But, you know, we did the whole swimming and, you know, everybody ate lunch and dinner in the same area. I will say this, the food was actually really good. We all drank tea, which was really funny because we would have a contest to see who could put the most sugar in their tea. And I typically won that contest. But, you know, it really made me remember back whenever I was a kid at camp. I just went once because it was probably about 2 or 3 years after I went, they actually shut that camp down. And I think they did another camp further south toward the, I believe it was the Houston area. But, you know, we did games. We played baseball. And if you've ever been pushed in a manual wheelchair while playing baseball, I will say that I got dumped out of my chair numerous times because the people driving my wheelchair had no sense of direction. So, you know, it was a fun time, but I thought the movie itself was extremely well produced. Even back using what we would consider archaic means of recording, I think they really did a great job.
Yeah, that was actually one of my favorite parts, is seeing all that archived footage of the camp and of the sit-ins and everything else. It made it just so much more authentic and really took you back to that time. So that was really cool. And no, I love hearing that, first of all, that you were at a hippie camp. That gives me so many things to imagine right now. So
yes, that, and I'll probably hear about that over and over.
Absolutely. You know, it's coming up on the podcast again. So I'm very glad you told me that. But no, and I think, Ralph, going back to your point, too, about seeing the creative living, and Michael, what you said about, you know, being a kid in a manual wheelchair at a camp when you were a kid, that's what fascinates me the most, because, you know, when I look at it from my perspective and watching those scenes of the camp play out, you know, there were scenes that struck me of, like, similarities where, you know, for instance, the scene when they're all just gathered around a table talking about their home lives and, you know, kind of like fighting for that independence and longing for it. That really struck a chord with me, because even as me, who is from a very different generation and much younger, you know, those conversations are very similar to the kind of discussions I've had with friends at SMA conferences. And, you know, I went to MBA camp when I was younger. And so those kind of themes, I think, play out regardless of generation, you know, when you talk about home life and, you know, longing for more independence and stuff. And I think I'm very privileged because, you know, I have parents who have always been really supportive of me. But even then, it's interesting to see those kind of themes play out. But what's really interesting, even more so, is that, you know, these were like kids all in manual chairs that, you know, didn't have the same technologies that I've been fortunate to have all of my life. And so to see that play out, and Ralph, what you said about, you know, coming up with creative solutions for getting around and that kind of thing, were there any specific things that stuck out to you?
Well, you know, for me, it was just the amazingness of the freedom there. You know, I thought, because sometimes now I realize, as I've become more limited, things like being able to go into a swimming pool or go into an ocean or do things like that. And, you know, I'm watching this movie again from decades ago. And, you know, you want to go in the pool, a couple of people picked you up and threw you in, you know, and you just enjoyed life. And so, you know, for me, I think that's what really struck me. I mean, you know, as a kid, I went to summer camp and it was an amazing experience. And again, for me, that would have been pre-symptoms of my limb girdle muscular dystrophy. And so these camps were, you know, mainstream camps, but the freedom you felt was amazing. And for these kids in this movie, I mean, it was like that on steroids, because, you know, right, the life they were living, I think they had certain limits in terms of their ability to get out and about. And all of a sudden it was like, well, you want to do it? Let's do it. You know, we'll figure it out how to do it.
Oh yeah. I love that line when Jim Labrecht, the co-writer, co-director of the film, and also one of the leads, you know, he's one of the people talking throughout, and they show footage of him at the camp when he was 15. And he talks at the beginning, he's like, I heard about this camp where, you know, the counselors let you smoke weed and play rock music and all this stuff. And I'm like, sign me up, you know. Like, no, and it really, and that's, it is fascinating to see how that just, when you put all these people together who had been conditioned, really, especially the ones that had come from institutions, which we'll talk about in a minute here, but that they had been really dehumanized for the longest time. And now here they are, part of this vibrant community, and everyone's helping each other and, you know, getting them into the pools. And, like, and, you know, it's like, you know, I mentioned that I went to MBA camp one time, and that was a great experience. And, you know, the counselors were basically your caregivers for the week. And that was my first time away from my parents. And, you know, I mean, really my first taste of, you know, okay, what is it going to be like managing my own care and that kind of thing. But it's still wildly different from the real world when you're having to train and manage caregivers and do all that. Whereas, you know, at camp, it was the counselors are trained for that. And, you know, you have everything taken care of. And so, I mean, it's a similar experience here where it's like, they have suddenly this sense of freedom that they never had before. And it was just fascinating to watch. So yeah, I loved all of that. Going back to that scene I mentioned a minute ago, where they're having conversations about that very subject, about independence and family life. I mentioned that those are conversations that are similar to things I've had, to ones I've had at SMA conferences. And, you know, like I think I've been very fortunate to have, like I said, parents who are very supportive, but I know plenty of other people with disabilities who are not in the same boat, and they still feel like their parents have like really restricted them. And that's no, I'm not trying to diss parents out there by any means. I'm just saying like people come from different circumstances. And so, in that conversation, was there anything, was there a moment there or anything that was said that like stuck out to you guys? Ralph, we'll go back to you first.
You know, that was an interesting piece for me, because being a parent myself, and, you know, my three kids are all in their 30s now, but it's hard, obviously, for parents, you know, to look at children, you know, to let go sometimes. You know, there's always a fearfulness. I mean, I look again during this crisis and pandemic, you know, how much I worry about kids and reaching out. And sometimes they have to set limits with me and say, Dad, you know, we're okay. But, you know, but I saw both sides of the kind of the paradigm there. But I think the reality is I kept thinking, you know, that all these kids must have come home, and did this camp really change their lives? And I would have loved to even have seen more and more of those conversations with parents in terms of, you know, not worry so much. I'm not going to get hurt. I know what I can do. I know my, you know, my limits, and I want to stretch them. I want to kind of, you know, reach out and do as much as I can. And I bet it was, you know, life-changing for all of these kids. Look at how some of them have really gone on to just excel in so many ways. So, you know, that really is an interesting piece of it for me in terms of the independence.
Absolutely. I think so too. And yeah, and it is interesting that, you know, they didn't have any parents featured in this. And really, as much as I love this movie, I think it could have easily been at least a 10 episode miniseries, because there are so many things that they could have expanded on. And I mean, I think it does a phenomenal job telling a cohesive story, but there are, and I'll get to something in a minute that I would have loved to see more on and I have questions about. But no, that's a great point. Michael, was there anything about that that conversation scene when, you know, they're talking around the table that stood out to you?
I think what stood out to me was just the openness that they weren't afraid to talk about anything. I mean, some of the kids had parents who were very overprotective, and they talked about that. Some of the kids had parents that were probably more similar to mine. You know, I know that whenever I got to go to camp, my camp lasted 2 weeks. And I think my parents were thrilled to death to ship me, you know, 180 miles away from home for 2 weeks. If anything, it was a vacation for them as well. So, you know, I grew up in an era where, you know, my wheelchair was never allowed to be used as an excuse. And I saw that a lot in the camp that I went to. These kids that I spent time around were just as almost as open as what I was. So I just, looking back on it now, I'm sure that it may have been through that generation that there was maybe a little bit more freedom to talk about things. So yeah, I mean, I found it completely interesting that just the openness in which these kids were allowed to speak and what they said.
Absolutely. And Michael, a question about that camp you went to, because you said it wasn't specifically for kids with disabilities. How did you manage care and independence while you were there? Did they have caregivers set up for you, or did you not need as much care back then? I was just curious.
Well, the majority of the people that were at this camp, which, like I said, this was in 1972. It was the camp counselors that were mainly your caregivers. You know, some kids needed more levels of care. Like, I needed help getting, you know, dressed and undressed, get in and, you know, out of bed, in and out of my chair to get into the swimming pool or other things. But it was mainly just the camp counselors. They didn't really have what I would consider PCAs. Back then,
it was
just the counselors themselves.
Right.
I know that when I spoke at UT Southwestern Medical Center to the graduating students that were going to be getting their doctorates in physical therapy about, oh, not too long before I spoke to them, they were sent to the muscular dystrophy camp to be counselors and to take care of the kids that were there and help them and learn what their limitations were. But back when I went to camp, it was mainly just the counselors that were responsible for a certain group of campers.
That's really interesting. Now, I mean, that is similar to, like, with MDA camp, it was, yeah, counselors were caregivers, too. So so that's really fascinating. But I'm glad you got to have that experience as well. And it's cool, the parallels between that and this one. So that's really cool.
Yeah, and Kevin, I was going to mention, though, yeah, that, and that did amaze me, too, in terms of the movie with some of the counselors, because I think they talked about them and, some of them picked up these jobs. And it was just fascinating to watch, because I don't think they necessarily had a lot of training and the work they would be doing, but they just came out there too and did it. And, you know, the participants, everybody just joined together into one big group.
Absolutely. And it's fascinating too, because they said in the movie that originally Jeanette did not start as a camp for people with disabilities. It was a general summer camp. I assume that it always had kind of the hippie vibe to it, but the hippie vibe is what influenced them to, you know, see that, okay, there wasn't the same opportunity for teenagers with disabilities, and they wanted to reach that community, and that's how it evolved. And so I know that's a great point, and it's really fascinating to see how they took on that job and, you know, without really an experience and wanted to do everything they could to make, you know, people with disabilities feel as equal as everyone else. So it's really cool to see. And Ralph, also going back to what we were just saying about, like, things that I would love to see expanded on more. So especially early on in the film, you know, romance is a big theme. And, you know, Jim talks about his developing his first romantic relationship at Jeanette with another camper there. And one of the things that I would have loved to know more about is the couple who met there at Camp Jeanette, both of whom have cerebral palsy. Their last name is Jacobson. And they said that line, I don't remember the male's name off the top of my head, but Denise is the wife. And but anyway, he said that when he came home and said, and when they were, you know, ready to get married and he told his mother about it, she said, you know, I understand why you would want to marry a handicapped girl, but could you not have picked someone with polio? And I was just like, it's such a, like, cynical and hilarious line at the same time, but it just speaks to those blatant prejudices that were there at the time, even within families who had disabilities. And so, but it was, you know, it was a fun moment there. But that's one couple that fascinated me in the film. And, you know, I mean, they hit on it a little bit and they show at the end that, you know, they are still married and they have kids. And I looked them up a little bit. I found just tidbits of information of them on Wikipedia, but I couldn't find much. And what their jobs were. I think she's a writer and he does something in finances. But I would be fascinated to see how that has, like, how they maintain their relationship, not in the, I mean, just in the sense of, you know, how they manage care and all of that. Because I, on this podcast, I've interviewed other couples before, but in pretty much all of those cases, it's usually one partner has SMA, the other one doesn't. And then, sometimes that the spouse is their caregiver, sometimes they have PCAs. But especially back, I mean, because this couple is probably in their 60s now. I mean, when they were, you know, getting married, I mean, that was only at the beginning of the disability revolution. And so they didn't have the same accommodations that we have now. And it's hard enough today finding good caregivers and PCAs. Again, no diss to caregivers out there. I'm just saying it's like the ones that are great are the best, but it can be hard to find those, and it can be hard to work around the logistics of government, bureaucracy, and all of that. And so I would be fascinated to learn more about their marriage and how they were able to get those accommodations and everything else. So that's a story I think that is a whole nother story in and of itself that I would be really interested in learning more about. Ralph, did you have anything, like, either on that or anything else you would let, you know, with the film that you would love to explore more?
Yeah, I think in terms of follow-up, like you said, this could have really even, you know, I think in today's era, you probably would become a 10-part miniseries or something. Yeah. But, you know, I think for some of these kids, again, going back home or going back to school then after this experience, how did it change them? How did it affect them? You know, how did it empower them? I mean, I would love to know some of the stories kind of after camp, you know, that next, the first week home or in September when you went back, you know, those that were in school or whatever. Just a lot of information that I would love to have, you know.
Absolutely.
Hey, Kevin.
Yes,
I think
go ahead.
They actually did kind of address it, or at least what I saw was that after a lot of these kids left Camp Jened, a lot of them reemerged later during the protests that they had.
Right.
So I think by being at that camp, they saw the need for dramatic changes in the way that the handicap were looked at through society's eyes. So I think a lot of them really got educated on what needed to be done to make these changes, and that's the reason why a lot of them reappeared during all of these protests.
No, absolutely, and I think that's a perfect segue into this next portion of the discussion where I want to talk about that, and specifically, let's start with the Willowbrook scene, which is horrifying, and, you know, I mean, this was really a wake-up call for the country at the time because they had remained, the institutions like this for people with mental and physical disabilities were, you know, I mean, equivalent to Nazi concentration camps, and they were kept under the wraps for the longest time. And when these reports went on, became available to the public, it was a huge wake-up call. And so, Ralph, you said before we were started recording that you had, you know, some knowledge of this being given your background in mental health. And so can you talk about that for a minute?
Yes, yeah, absolutely, because obviously I remember some of these reports coming out of Willowbrook and other places, and obviously, you know, my life as a mental health counselor and working in that arena, you know, there was this whole movement, of course, to deinstitutionalize eventually, but what happened, it really was a similar situation where, you know, some of these institutions were just really terrible and the living conditions were very difficult. And I think, you know, a lot of people didn't realize that that existed. And finally, you know, kind of the lid was blown off all of that. And, you know, the reporting and the media, and it really led to some changes and moving people out of institutions into the community. But that was a big movement in the mental health arena, obviously, in terms of physical disabilities, too, and something that needed to happen a long time before it did.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Michael, do you remember when these reports came out as well, or any connection to that?
No, to be quite honest with you, I had never heard of Willowbrook until I saw this movie.
Yeah.
You know, I knew that facilities like this existed, but to actually see it and to see these kids so emaciated, sitting in a corner or sitting in the middle of the room in their own feces, being fed nothing but porridge. And I believe that they were only fed for a certain amount of time per day, like 3 minutes or 5 minutes, because that's all they had time for, given the fact that they had so many people there.
Yeah.
That was just, it was scary. But even though it was scary, I think everybody knew that it existed, but until it came to light in the video and they saw it on the news, that's when I think reality set in, and that's when people started saying, we cannot do this anymore.
Right, absolutely.
And Willowbrook had been around. I mean, I think it had opened in the 40s, and by the mid-50s had reached full capacity for like 4,000 people, you know, so, you know, just huge in terms of the numbers. So, yeah, quite a part of American history, you know.
Right. Well, and in the movie, when Judy Heumann, who really becomes the protagonist of this film, rightfully so, when she talks about how, because she was a counselor at Jened, and she talked about how there were kids who came from Willowbrook and other institutes, and to see how they behaved, like when they had all this food before them and they were just gorging themselves because they had never seen that much food in their lives. It's just like, it's frightening, but also, this is what led to, the second half of the film that is much more positive, and this is, where the disability rights movement began. So on that line, were there any moments from the scenes with Judy Heumann and the 504 sit-ins that stood out to you guys in particular? Let's go around again. Ralph.
Yeah, there's so many amazing scenes, obviously closing the streets in New York and just, wheelchairs blocking an intersection and how quickly the entire city clogged up with, this one intersection being shut down, and then going in and really fighting, legislators and others responsible for enacting the laws that we needed and, just shutting down. I know there are disability groups that have done some of that even recently. We have been looking at trying to do, I think we were planning a September Lobby Day event in Washington, D.C. Obviously, this year, things may not happen as we planned. And while we're not looking at those levels of protests yet, I think there are things that even 30 years after the ADA that need to be improved in terms of accessibility. So I think it's a fight. We can look back at this history and learn from them because they were gutsy people. They really did some amazing things.
Absolutely. I think the New York closing the street down was, the scene that really stuck out to me because I knew about the 504 sit-ins, the basics of. Actually, the first time I heard about it was a few years ago. Comedy Central did a sketch about it on Drunk History, and they had guys like Zach Anner, who's one of my favorite comedians, participate in that. And so they got across the basics of what happened to the 504 sit-ins. And, of course, it's all the more emotional and invigorating when you see actual footage of it play out and the whole story here. But yeah, the New York closing the streets down is something I didn't know about, and seeing that play out was fascinating. So yeah, just when you think about with the 504 sit-ins, that they gave up everything from caregivers, and they really were so headstrong and led by just the fierceness of Judy Heumann and all of that. And it's a wake up call for me as, again, someone who was born 3 years after the ADA law was passed. I'm very privileged, and I know we still have a ways to go, and that's kind of the point I made in my column about this film a couple weeks ago, is that these people did a tremendous amount for our community, but at the same time, we still have ways to go. But just the fact that everything they did is why I have the freedoms I have today, it's astounding, and it's crazy that all of this is not some distant memory in our nation's history, but it is very recent, Michael, did you have any moments there in those scenes you wanted to point out, or just any takeaways?
I think there were two things that really struck me that I actually took from this was the first being when they blocked the city streets and they were all out there in their wheelchairs and their braces and their crutches, not moving away from traffic, just basically getting their word out. I thought that was extremely powerful. And another thing that really struck me was the level of support when they were doing their sit-in, the level of support that they got. The Black Panthers came in and gave them food. There were a lot of other people that donated stuff to them during their sit-in. So I think they saw a lot of public support, even though the public didn't want to be seen. They still supported the efforts that they were going through. So to me, it was just fascinating.
Yeah. No, that was a great moment where you had groups like the Black Panthers and LGBT groups and other minorities coming in to support, and it was one community, but that was linked to others as well, and this was it was so reflective of the time and the social revolution. So that was fascinating. And one other thing, I noticed is when they showed this footage and they showed like news reports of the sit-ins, just the way that our community was described back then, they called them the handicapped, you know? Like, I mean, like there's some other world, you know, that alone was fascinating to me, because just to see how the wording has changed since then is so reflective of how society views us. And I mean, that, I mean, it, you know, there's, like I said, there's still ways to go there. And it ties to the point that Denise Jacobson makes at the end of the film, where she says, you know, a law is great, and but it only means so much if, and I'm paraphrasing here, but it only means so much if, because unless you change the attitudes of society, then that law will only mean so much, you know?
And Well, yeah. Kevin, I was going to say, it was a different world. And I, you know, that's why I'm still struck by the, not only the street closing scene and the accessing the buildings, but, you know, think about curb cutouts and didn't exist. I mean, people getting wheelchairs into streets and difficult situations, or getting into buildings. You know, we didn't have all the ramps and all the, you know, just the amazing work that they did in a very different era.
Right. And that scene where Jim took a, it took the subway, and he was trying to get out, and there was no ramps anywhere, so he had to climb his way out, and, you know, and
yes,
just things, I mean, I just can't, and that would have not been an option for me at all, because I don't have any kind of upper body strength, and so, like, I'm fully dependent on my chair and accessibility options, so it's just, it's astounding, those, you know, moments like that, but...
Okay, if I can say something here,
absolutely, go ahead.
I know that when I went to the Lions Club camp, back then it was known as the Lions Club Camp for Crippled Children. And when I was in Scottish Rite Hospital as a child, Scottish Rite was known as Scottish Rite Crippled, or Scottish Rite Hospital for Crippled Children.
Yeah.
And so they've taken the word cripple out of a lot of these titles, because they know that society is not going to put up with it anymore.
Right, right. Absolutely. No, that, and it is, I mean, it's like, and, you know, it's, and going back to, like, the title of the film, it, I think it takes that and try to flip it on its heels, and in a way is, like, it's a word that's been used in a derogatory fashion for the longest time, and now it's, like, our community taking back ownership of that word and applying it in a different context, but yeah, no, I mean, just the way of, like, you know, I always, you know, talk about us as people with disabilities, but you know just a few decades ago we were the handicapped, you know, like we were some other it's a dehumanization, really, you know, just in simple wording. So yeah, no, there, I could go on all day about this film. I think it's fascinating, and you know, there's just the way it fuses these different stories together, and the closing montage was great. It's also, it's like really uplifting, and also, when they talk about people who are in the movie who have passed away, it's just a really, I mean, it's so powerful. I mean, all these things, that these are the people who fought for what our world looks like today. And like I said, it's not perfect, but we've come a long way since then. So, do you guys have any other closing thoughts or points you wanted to say about the film before we close out?
No, I think we've covered it. It was, yeah, it was just fabulous. I would recommend it for everyone.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and
I'm
fine with everything that we've talked about. I think we covered everything from A to Z.
Yeah. No, there. I mean, it's a great film, and like I said, I mean, if you haven't checked it out, please go do so. And you know, we've got discussions on it in our forums, which you can check out. We'd love to hear from you there. But yeah, no, that's great. And Michael, Ralph, I want to thank you for joining me today. This was fantastic. Ralph, especially, thank you for coming on.
Thank you both.
Yeah, thank you, Ralph.
Absolutely. And again, you can find Ralph's column at MuscularDystrophyNewsToday.com. It is Living, Learning, and Thriving. And for our listeners out there, you can hear more stories and discussions like this by subscribing to the SMA News Today podcast. You can also connect with us directly on our forums, as I mentioned, and follow our main website at smanewstoday.com for the latest SMA news and perspectives. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next time. Take care, everyone.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to SMA News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.smanewstoday.com. And be sure to follow us on social media and join our SMA News Today forums, a trusted SMA community ready to welcome you anytime.